Good morning, and welcome to BT's first half results presentation for the financial year 2021. My name is Mark Lidiard from the BT Investor Relations team. Hosting today's event are Philip Jansen, Chief Executive, and Simon Lowth, Chief Financial Officer. Before we start, I'd like to draw your attention to the usual forward-looking statements on slide two and our latest annual report for examples of the factors that could cause actual results to differ from any forward-looking statements we may make. Both the slide and the annual report can be found on our website. With that, I'll now hand over to Philip.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining this morning's call. As is normal for the first half results, Simon and I will be making some prepared comments before taking your questions. As usual, for the Q&A session, I have my whole executive team with me. Moving straight to the highlights slide. Despite the pandemic, BT had another good quarter, delivering results in line with our expectations for the first half of the year. For the full year, given the reduced uncertainty, further evidence of the fundamental importance of our products and services demonstrated through COVID-19, and the confidence we have in our operational performance, we are narrowing our full year 2021 EBITDA outlook range to 7.3 billion-7.5 billion pounds, which is clearly a positive move. Looking further ahead, given the solid progress we have made in our delivery of our strategy and transformation, we expect EBITDA in the financial year ending March 2023 to be at least 7.9 billion pounds, with sustainable growth from this level going forward. This underpins our commitment to the reinstatement of our dividend next year, whilst ensuring that we can continue to drive value-creating investments in our investor relations networks and products. Simon will talk you through the building blocks that support this medium-term outlook, but let me first deal with the results from the first half. Turning to slide five, you can see our group financials for the first 6 months of September, which, as I said, were in line with our expectations. To summarize, revenue in the first half was resilient at 10.6 billion pounds, down 7%. EBITDA was down 5% to 3.7 billion pounds. CapEx at 2 billion pounds was up 5%. Normalized free cash flow of 422 million pounds was down 30%. Moving to slide six and some of the operational highlights from the first half that demonstrate continued successful execution against our strategy. We've continued to invest in our networks across mobile, fixed, and core to build the strongest foundations. 5G is now live in 112 towns and cities, more than any other operator. With EE winning all seven RootMetrics awards for the U.K.-wide mobile network performance for the sixth consecutive half year in H1, including the best 5G network, it leaves the business well-positioned for any new 5G device launches, such as the iPhone 12, for which we've seen encouraging pre-orders and pre-sales. With our new enhanced consumer KPIs, you can see we already have 1.2 million 5G-ready users, an increase of over 850,000 in quarter two alone. We also announced both Nokia and Ericsson as key providers of equipment for our 5G radio access network, which helps form a key part of our strategic response to the U.K. government decision around the use of high-risk vendors in the U.K. Our partnership with these strategic vendors will allow us to build upon our leading position in U.K. 5G. Following the easing of lockdown restrictions at the end of the first quarter, we were able to re-accelerate our FTTP build to a record level of 40,000 premises passed per week. Openreach FTTP footprint has reached 3.5 million premises, putting us firmly on track to achieve our 4.5 million target by the end of March and continue on a trajectory to reach 20 million premises by the mid to late 2020, if the conditions are right. Openreach's local marketing and FTTP-only offers are proving successful, with all the major CPs now consuming FTTP. This has led to increased sales, and currently we're selling at about 13,000 a week. Looking at BT's consumer division, the second quarter saw the largest quarterly growth of FTTP customers to date, bringing their total customer base to around 600,000. Having achieved a low-cost, fast-paced, and high-quality sustainable build, Clive and the team have now shifted their focus to further improving and scaling the provisioning process and cost. In May, we outlined phase two of our cost transformation program, which will see us further modernize BT and reduce our cost base. Despite the disruption caused by the pandemic, our plans remain firmly on track, generating annualized savings of around £350 million in the first half, at a cost of around £160 million. We also outlined a number of short-term actions we've been implementing to mitigate the impact from COVID-19 on the group. Simon will cover some specific examples which illustrate the significant strides we've already taken to simplify our products, processes, and systems over the first few months of this multi-year program. Looking now at creating standout customer experiences on slide 7. We aim to create these by leveraging the strength of our superior networks to differentiate our products, propositions, and service. We want to offer products that are high quality and good value for money. We launched our Halo product for consumers last October, which now makes up nearly 40% of the entire BT broadband base, providing customers with the best connection and experience with double data on mobile and inclusive home tech expert support. As part of Enterprise's small business support scheme, which we announced in July, we launched Halo for Business, which means SMEs can also benefit from this market-leading convergence product, including a digital voice line. In September, we announced the full works plan for the iPhone. This is a global first for EE, providing three new benefits to customers for the duration of their contract. That's Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, and Apple Arcade, all at unbeatable value for money. In addition to our Halo convergence vehicle for BT, we are also bringing together BT Broadband with EE Mobile in a best of both approach. Now, this premium convergence combination is expected to further drive cross-sale opportunities and improve ARPU. And lastly, in global, we further expanded our portfolio of collaboration services by launching Zoom with Meetings from BT on our new cloud-optimized platform, offering global organizations enhanced managed services and security. These high-quality, high-value products are clearly resonating with our customers, and a key part of what has driven 17 successive quarters of growth in group net promoter score. Also supporting improved NPS are lower complaints that have reduced by 20% year-on-year for BT consumer broadband and have halved over the last 2 years. Complaints about EE Mobile remain equal lowest of any UK major mobile network operator. Separately, and as a result of the hard work and dedication of everyone who supports our apprentices, BT has been ranked the top commercial organisation for employing apprentices by the National Apprenticeship Service. And finally, I'm absolutely delighted and enormously proud to share that the work of a number of colleagues during the pandemic has been formally recognised with the award of MBEs in the latest Queen's Birthday Honours List. I believe this is the first time that telecom workers have been recognised in this way. Now, all of our colleagues have worked tremendously hard to keep the nation connected. But for Lucy Baker, Ian Hammond, John Hayday, Peter Martin, Reza Ranama, Karen Smith, Gemma Towers, and Scott McPartland, I'd just like to reiterate my thanks to you and congratulate you all on receiving such a prestigious award. Before we look at business unit performance in more detail, let me now hand over to Simon, who'll take you through the group's first half results, update you on our modernization plan, and as I said earlier, provide you with a roadmap of how we'll achieve our medium-term EBITDA outlook of at least £7.9 billion by 2023. Simon.
Well, thank you, Philip, and good morning to everyone. I'm going to summarise our financial performance for the half year and the progress on our modernisation programme before providing updates on our group's net debt and liquidity, on our pension position, and then on our outlook. So, starting with our financial performance on slide 9, adjusted revenue for the half year was £10.6 billion. That's down 7%, primarily due to declines in legacy products, a later-than-normal iPhone launch, and, of course, the impact of COVID-19, including reduced BT Sport revenue and a reduction in business activity in our enterprise units. These declines were partially offset by higher rental bases of fibre-enabled products and Ethernet in Openreach. We remain on track to end the year in line with our guidance for a decline in revenue of between 5% and 6%. Operating costs were down 8% due to lower product costs and commissions, sports rights rebates, and the cost savings that we have generated through our modernization program and other cost initiatives, including short-term COVID-19 mitigating actions. Adjusted EBITDA for the half year was £3.7 billion. That's down 5%. Moving below EBITDA on slide 10, depreciation and amortization was £2.2 billion. That's up 2%. Our adjusted net finance expense was £384 million, up 7%. The adjusted tax charge was £236 million. That's down 18%. Reflecting an effective tax rate of 20%. So this resulted in adjusted profit after tax of £950 million, down 18%. Specific items after tax of £94 million included restructuring and property rationalisation costs of £163 million, a regulatory charge of £18 million, and interest on pensions of £9 million, partially offset by a net credit from divestment-related items of £66 million. Reported profit after tax for the period was £856 million, down 20%. And finally, our reported EPS was 8.6 pence per share, and our adjusted EPS was 9.6 pence per share. Moving on to cash flow on slide 11, we delivered £422 million of normalised free cash flow in the half year. That's down 30%, primarily due to lower EBITDA, some offsetting movements in working capital and timing of cash tax payments. We remain on track to be in the range of £1.2 billion to £1.5 billion for the full year. We paid cash tax and interest charges of £570 million and lease payments of £363 million and then incurred a net outflow of £281 million from changes in working capital and some other movements. We invested £2.1 billion in cash capital expenditure in the half year. That's up 1%. I'll provide more details on our CapEx investments shortly. Cash-specific items costs totaled £221 million, including restructuring payments of £198 million. Our reported free cash flow was £201 million. That's down 70%, reflecting the lower normalised free cash flow and the increase in cash-specific costs, which last year included a £210 million inflow from the sale of BT Centre. We paid £425 million into our pension schemes, gross of tax, with a corresponding £90 million of cash tax benefit, resulting in free cash flow post-pension deficit payments, negative £139 million. Moving to our major investment programs on slide 12. Reported CapEx was up 5% at £2 billion for the half year, driven primarily by investments in our FTTP and our mobile networks. Within this total, we invested £1.1 billion in our networks, that's up 9%, £455 million in customer-driven capex, £364 million in our systems and IT, and then the remaining £52 million was spent on non-network infrastructure. We continue to expect reported capex for the full year to be between £4 billion and £4.3 billion. But turning now to our transformation program on slide 13, our objective, very simply put, is to modernize BT, and we made solid progress in the first half of this multi-year program. As a reminder, we are simplifying our product portfolio. We're simplifying and automating our customer journeys. We're moving to a modern, modular IT architecture, and we're migrating customers from our decades-old legacy networks to modern FTTP and 5G networks. During the first half year, we continued to simplify our organizational structure to standardize and automate end-to-end processes and to further leverage shared services. Modernization activities span the group, and in the first half, we retired 8 legacy broadband products which had outdated features such as low speeds or cat usage out of a total of 25 legacy broadband products. And we expect to retire the majority of the remainder by the end of this year. We doubled the percentage of Ethernet orders which are fast-tracked to use existing nearby fiber to about 40% of all orders. On average, these circuits now take just 12 days to deliver versus an overall average of 42 days. We also signed a number of deals with leading software vendors in order to supply our modular IT architecture. We've continued to improve the capabilities of our procurement and our supply chain functions by adding new digital tools and embedding some new capabilities such as value engineering and Lean Six Sigma that will reduce supply chain risk, simplify our buying processes, and drive down the cost of external purchases. In the first half, we delivered £352 million in gross annualized cost savings in line with our expectations to achieve savings of £1 billion per annum by the end of March 2023 and £2 billion by the end of March 2025. Cost to achieve these savings in the first half was £163 million. In September, as part of our program to modernize BT, we launched a review of our UK redundancy and paid leaver terms. The purpose of the review is to create a simple, consistent, and fair set of severance terms that will apply equally to all UK employees in BT, EE, PlusNet, and Openreach. And today, we have a number of different options across the business. We've started a consultation process and we'll be talking to the unions with the aim of reaching agreement on any changes. Beyond this program, we're challenging every element of our cost base, and we've taken specific actions to manage spend and to reduce discretionary costs in order to mitigate the financial impacts of COVID-19. So far this year, we have cancelled or delayed recruitment right across the group. We've worked with our suppliers to identify opportunities to deliver significant and sustainable cost reductions across the supply chain. We've focused and rephased our marketing spend, and we've obviously reviewed rigorously and reprioritized discretionary spend for the whole of this year in areas such as travel, training, external fees. At the end of the half, there were 3,600 fewer full-time equivalent roles across the group. That's a reduction of over 3% versus the end of the prior year. Finally, we continue to move forward with targeted disposals so that we can focus on our core business to deliver converged connectivity and services. And on the 1st of October, we completed the sale of selected domestic operations and infrastructure in Latin America. Moving on to net debt and liquidity on slide 14. At the half year, we had financial net debt of £11.3 billion with no net change since the end of the prior year, as the £425 million payments we made into our pension schemes were offset by the normalised free cash flow of £422 million. We remain well placed for this period of uncertainty with cash and current investments of £6.5 billion and an undrawn committed credit facility of £2.1 billion at the end of the half year. During the half year and following our recommitment to our credit rating target of BBB+ and a minimum rating of BBB, all of the major agencies reconfirmed their ratings of BBB or equivalent. Moving to our pension positions on slide 15, at the 30th of September 2020, the IAS 19 deficit was £4 billion net of tax. That is up £3 billion since the valuation at the 31st of March 2020, which reflected the unusually high credit spreads at that time. The increase in the deficit reflects a decrease in the real discount rate, principally reflecting a fall in credit spreads, partially offset by deficit contributions over the period and higher than expected asset returns. Moving on to the triennial funding valuation, as you know, this considers the values of the assets and the liabilities as at the 30th of June 2020 in order to determine future cash contributions. Discussions with the BT Pension Scheme Trustee are progressing, and we continue to expect to conclude these negotiations in the first half of the next calendar year. As we did 3 years ago, we're considering a number of options for funding the deficit, including potentially non-cash contributions. Finally, moving to our outlook on slide 16. Since providing our outlook at our first quarter trading update, we've made good progress on our modernization and cost-saving program, and despite the challenging and uncertain macroeconomic environment, demand for our products has remained robust. We've seen some of the most heavily impacted areas of our business recover quickly through the second quarter. For example, Openreach provisions and upgrades and in BT Sport. While we will likely be impacted by business failures going forward, the digital transformation driven by businesses that survive, or indeed new ones that emerge, mean that our platforms are becoming more important than ever. As a result, we have made a positive move in our EBITDA outlook range for this year to a range of £7.3 billion to £7.5 billion, so at the low end, that's £100 million higher than we had previously forecast. Our outlook range for normalised free cash flow remains unchanged. There are two specific reasons. First, we expect to increase stock levels to manage through the end of the Brexit transition period and the possible disruptions to supply chains that a no-deal scenario may bring. Second, we are making a final purchase of necessary Huawei equipment, including spares, prior to the ban on purchasing new Huawei 5G kit from the 31st of December 2020. We are firmly on track with the delivery of our strategy and our transformation programs that we set out in May this year. As a result, we expect EBITDA in the financial year ending March 2023 to be back at the pre-COVID level of at least £7.9 billion with sustainable growth from this level forward. Our EBITDA progression will be driven by our recovery from the impacts of COVID-19, sales of our converged and growth products, including FTTP, 5G, VoIP, and security, and with inflation-linked prices at both the retail and wholesale levels, and the significant savings from our modernization and cost saving programs. These factors will in combination offset legacy product declines and normal inflation in our cost base. The headwinds that we've experienced over the past few years from regulatory price reductions and increasing cumulo rates have now receded. This growth in EBITDA will underpin the planned reinstatement of our revised dividend while ensuring that we can continue to drive value-creating investment in our networks and in our products. So, to conclude, we delivered results in line with our expectations, made a solid start to our modernization and cost-saving program, and this progress, along with continued robust demand for our products and services, has led us to increase the low end of our EBITDA outlook range for this year and to expect EBITDA of at least £7.9 billion in the financial year ending March 2023, underpinning the reinstatement of our revised dividend and our value-creating investment plan. And with that, I'll now hand back to Philip, who will talk you through the business unit results in more detail.
Thanks, Simon. So now looking at the CFU performance in more detail. Let's start with consumer on slide 18. Revenue for the first half fell 6%, predominantly due to the continued impact of COVID-19, with revenue from BT Sport and roaming significantly down, as well as the closure of our retail stores in quarter one. A declining base of voice-only customers and a later-than-normal iPhone launch has also impacted revenue. EBITDA fell 9% due to lower revenue, continued investment in the fairness commitments made to Ofcom, and increased bad debt. This has been partially offset by sports rights rebates and tight management of costs, and I should say that we don't expect any further material sports rights rebates in the second half of the year. COVID-19 will continue to affect consumer with further impacts from lower sport revenue from pubs and clubs, more price-conscious customers, reduced roaming activity, and increased costs from major handset launches. Operationally, broadband and mobile churn in the second quarter both landed at 1.1%, each improving 0.1 percentage points year on year, driven by our continued focus on pricing, market competitiveness, fairness initiatives, and lower market activity. As well as accelerating our 5G and FTTP base, the success of which I've already touched upon, we've also driven fairness initiatives even further. Last month, we provided customers with increased transparency on future price rises, announcing that increases for new and upgrading customers have been standardized across all consumer products and across all brands at CPI plus 3.9% per year. Major growth in data usage, continued investment in our leading networks, superior propositions and UK-based customer services all support this standard annual increase. Moving to enterprise on slide 19, revenue fell 9%, primarily due to the reduced business activity as a result of COVID-19 and ongoing declines in legacy products. Operating costs were down, mainly due to the revenue decline and cost transformation. And as a result, EBITDA was down 13%. Excluding the impact of the fleet and ticket divestments in enterprise, revenue was down 7% and EBITDA 12%. We expect to see further impacts of COVID-19 from business insolvencies in the second half, particularly among our SME customers. Now, although the size of the impact will depend on the level and length of government support, it also affects our wholesale business, which indirectly serves SMEs. Enterprise continues to focus on reducing its cost base through supplier and product rationalization. It has over 500 individual cost reduction initiatives ongoing, and during the quarter, introduced a number of measures to further tighten third-party costs. Operationally, retail order intake increased 3% to £3.2 billion, and wholesale order intake decreased 1% to £1.1 billion, both on a 12-month rolling basis. We continue to support small business across the UK through our Small Business Support Scheme. As part of this, we recently announced a partnership with Square to help EE's small business customers securely accept contactless mobile payments. We also launched a bursary scheme, which includes Halo for Business, and will be made available to 1,000 eligible companies, initially with potential to expand that scheme. We've extended our 5G development program for enterprise customers and have agreed a new landmark partnership deal with Belfast Harbour to deploy a 5G private network. This installation will allow the harbour to boost productivity, public safety, and physical security across the port and surrounding areas, while also addressing climate change. We've also partnered with Stirling University on its Living Laboratory project, which sees BT helping to create a state-of-the-art environmental monitoring system using 5G and complementary tech aimed at driving a green recovery. Moving to global on slide 20, the 13% revenue decline was largely driven by the impact of COVID-19, although it had a less material impact on EBITDA, which declined 5%. Excluding the impact of our divested domestic Spanish business, foreign exchange movements, and prior year one-offs, revenue was down 10%, but EBITDA was actually up 6%. Looking at the revenue decline in more detail, we saw lower non-contracted business and some milestone slippages as a result of COVID-19. Further revenue declines were driven by our strategic decisions on lower margin businesses, legacy portfolio decline, and a £16 million negative impact from foreign exchange movements. These were only partly offset by higher conferencing volumes. As I mentioned, underlying EBITDA was up, as lower revenue was more than offset by lower operating costs, reflecting our ongoing transformation programs in global and COVID-19 mitigation actions. Looking forward, we are seeing a short-term reduction in spending and a more cautious approach from our multinational customers, resulting in cancellations and delays to purchasing cycles. Of course, this will negatively impact revenue and EBITDA in the second half of the year. Order intake in the quarter was around £800 million, down 43%, due to a number of large renewals last year and the impact of COVID-19. However, on a rolling 12-month basis, it was up 10% to £4.1 billion. Finally, looking at Openreach on slide 21, the 2% revenue growth in the first half was driven by higher fibre and Ethernet volumes, partly offset by declines in legacy copper products. The first quarter in particular was impacted by COVID-19, driving lower provision and upgrade activity, partly offset by lower churn. EBITDA was up 3% compared to last year, with the revenue growth being partially offset by higher operating costs. The increase in operating costs was primarily driven by investment in people to deliver better service, partially offset by ongoing efficiency programs and reductions in discretionary spend. Throughout the quarter, Openreach took steps to increase capacity to deliver record levels of engineering work to bring customers back into service safely and quickly to support a nation working from home. I'm pleased to say that Openreach infrastructure delivery and maintenance of customer service was recognized in best ever perception results for copper, fiber, and Ethernet access from our CP. As well as the progress we've made on the FTTP build, Openreach announced early this month that they plan to stop selling new legacy copper services in a further 51 exchange areas, bringing the total number of exchange locations covered by this plan in the next 12 months to 169, which covers 1.8 million premises. In these exchange areas, the focus will be on providing FTTP, as they will all have reached 75% FTTP coverage. As we accelerate the rollout of FTTP, we'll be issuing these stop sell notices on a regular basis. Now, we look forward to receiving more clarity and detail on how the £5 billion government subsidy may be allocated in more rural areas and the final WFTMR document from Ofcom ahead of the new regulatory framework being in place from April next year. To summarize on slide 22, despite the impact of the pandemic in the first half, BT has had a good start to the year and delivered results in line with our expectations. Our confidence in our operational performance has led to a positive move in our EBITDA outlook for this year. And the medium-term EBITDA outlook we have published today of at least £7.9 billion to March 2023 reflects the growing confidence we have in our execution of our strategy for modernising BT and underpins our plans to reinstate the dividend next year and to drive value-creating investments in our networks and in our products. I continue to be excited about the prospects and the purpose for BT. So as ever, thank you for engaging with us today, and we look forward to answering your questions. As per normal, I would like to cover as many questions as possible, so please could I ask you to limit each of you to one question, and then Simon and the team will do our very best to answer them as succinctly as possible. So with that, what I'd like to do now is ask the operator to open the lines, and I'll get Simon to come and join me on the stage, and let's take the first question.
Thank you, Philip. For everyone, just a reminder, those that perhaps are unsure, it's keying star one on your phone so that you can queue to ask the questions. You can still hear the call, but we do have the first question. This is from Akhil Dattani from JP Morgan. Thank you, Akhil, you're live.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking the question. Maybe I can start with the new midterm guidance that you've provided today. And there's really just two parts to what I'm trying to get some color around. The first is, essentially, if we take the midpoint of this year's EBITDA guidance and the guidance you've given for March 23, that's 7% cumulative EBITDA growth, which is about $500 million. So I guess, firstly, just trying to understand if we could get a bit of color on the drivers of that. So just any sort of color and commentary around revenue growth, cost-cutting, and mix shift between the different segments. So that would be the first bit of it. And the second piece of that is, I guess, just trying to understand how we should think about the phasing of that EBITDA growth. Do we think about it as relatively linear across the coming years, or is it potentially phased a bit differently to that? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Simon can make a comment on some of the specifics that you raised. I think, you know, the move today to sort of upgrade our lower end from 7.2 to 7.3 narrows the range clearly, and that sort of underlines our confidence in the performance we've got in the first half, but also for the remainder of this year. And again, you can sort of work out the number of things that are in that, but you can see a big performance on our costs. So what I'd say to you is, if you look at what's happened in the first half, I think we're pleased with what we've done on controlling our costs, and we're pleased with what we've done on our transformation program. You're delivering £352 million of annualized savings in the first 6 months of our sort of £2 billion gross saving target over the next 5 years is a really encouraging start. So when you put it all in the round, what we're really saying is we feel like we've got control of our costs. Obviously, there's going to be some kickback at some stage from a COVID-19 bounce back, but we're not planning on that in the second half particularly. So I'll let Simon, I mean, do you want to add anything to that, Simon?
I mean, I think on the key drivers of the recovery in our EBITDA from FY21 to FY23, where we get back to our pre-COVID levels. Firstly, there is the recovery from COVID. We and essentially built a plan around an assumption that we are through the pandemic by the fiscal year 23. Recall that we essentially took about a £400 to £500 million EBITDA hit as we went into COVID. Quite a chunk of that was associated with activity like BT Sport revenues in pubs and clubs, like roaming, like out-of-bundle charges, which as we emerge from the pandemic is EBITDA that we will recover as we move forward. Secondly, we announced a cost transformation program, a modernization program, that will deliver £1 billion of gross annual savings in FY23, and we're firmly on track to deliver that. And if you think about the normal course inflation, it's a small proportion of that. So the ability to deliver net cost savings is within our control. That would be a second very important driver. But in addition to that, we are seeing robust demand for our converged and our growth products. We have also obviously got a lot of our product portfolio now is indexed in consumer and in Openreach. So those are the probably the big drivers: recovery, delivery of sustained net cost reduction, and also growth from our strategic and converged products. And those together will more than offset the continuing sort of legacy declines that we've got on particularly traditional voice. But each year it goes by, that's a smaller base. And then, as I mentioned in my remarks just now, do recall that a couple of really significant headwinds that we faced in the last 3 or 4 years, namely wholesale, regulated wholesale price reductions, particularly in Openreach, and a significant increase in cumulative rates, those have essentially now receded. And then your other question was on the shape of the recovery. I mean, I think we set a clear guidance for FY23. The shape of the recovery is going to depend a lot on the macroeconomic and circumstances, the shape of recovery from the pandemic during the course of the next 18 months or so. Also, do bear in mind that the delivery on the cost transformation and indeed the indexation starts to accumulate more as you move out over time.
And that's why I was saying, just on your question about the linear, who knows? But you know, given we've got good control of our costs, if there is a decent bounce back next year or the year after, you know, we can release some of that cost behind revenue growth that comes on the COVID, hopefully COVID-19 bounce back.
Great, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the next question is Maurice Patrick from Barclays. Thank you, Maurice.
Yeah. Morning, guys. Yes, Maurice here. Linked to the same question. I mean, the slide 16 is very helpful, providing the drivers, and thank you, Simon, for kind of elucidating on some of the points there. But looking at the numbers there, it looks as though, given you've got £1 billion of gross cost savings, and the shape, the size of the charts there, it looks as though all that EBITDA growth is coming from cost cutting rather than revenue growth, or rather, a lot of that cost saving is being reinvested in growth. So I guess the question is, when should we expect to be back to underlying revenue growth? Ignore the COVID recovery. I mean, take your point on that in terms of that coming back, but ignoring the MVNO loss. But when do you think we'll start seeing revenues actually growing on a structural basis rather than just being cost-based? Thank you.
Yeah, I guess, Simon should give his opinion. Again, it's being confident on the short-term revenue profile is difficult given the circumstance we've talked about, right? So again, we keep repeating, we feel strongly that the modernization program, the cost control we've put in place, and all the stuff we talked about just a minute ago is going to deliver good results. What we're hopeful is that when this is behind us and there's a vaccine and the economy is back to a more normalized approach, we would like to see us, you know, seeing a positive revenue growth post-2023. So, you know, what we're saying here today is, in 2023, $7.9 billion EBITDA, and moving forward from there onwards with some revenue growth is our target. Simon, do you want anything?
No, sorry.
I couldn't quite hear the whole question.
Maurice, your line was a little bit distorted, but I think that's right, Philip. I think that a significant driver of the EBITDA recovery over the course of the next couple of years, clearly does come from actions that are entirely in our control, like driving cost reduction. We will see growth in some of our converged and strategic products, but in the next two years or so, we've still got that drag from traditional voice decline. We've also got a loss of a MVNO contract. So, Philip, the goal of driving sustainable revenue growth from FY23. Where we'll start seeing.
Yeah, and just Alex, you said, I was trying to hear some of your question. I think, Maurice, the other thing to say is if you've got on one side, you've got the cost under control, but also you've got in place a sort of revenue model. Once, as Simon said, some of the legacy old voice revenue disappears, we have got indexation and we have got CPI inflationary increases built into decent chunks of our business, particularly around Openreach and particularly in consumer now. So you can see cost on the one hand, entirely controlled. A model for revenue growth that is beginning to emerge, but obviously there's this uncertainty in the middle about what happens to the economy, which obviously is the macro effect, which we can't really forecast really accurately. Maurice, I hope that answers. We couldn't hear all your questions. Does that do it?
That's great, yeah. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Maurice.
Excellent, thank you. So this is Carl Murdoch-Smith from Berenberg. Thank you, Carl.
Hi, thanks, guys. I just wanted to ask a question about headcount in Openreach and kind of how you are thinking about insourced versus outsourced engineering capability going forwards. in the release you talk about the large tender process that you went through in the period, kind of suggesting potentially more outsourcing going forwards. And I also notice that the headcount in Openreach has gone down in the half, which bucks the trend of the last few years. I was wondering, is that a signal that you are thinking of more outsourcing going forwards, or is it simply a sign that with COVID-19 that's having an impact on your ability to hire and your ability to train?
Thank you. Charles, good question. I'll get Clive to just give you a view on that. Let me just say one thing. I think, you know, the story in Openreach is incredibly positive. I'm sure you can see that. You know, we're building FTTP so fast. We're connecting people really quickly. Sales are fantastic with FTTP at 13,000 a week. And operationally, you know, the feedback from CPs is very strong, particularly given the sheer weight of activity in that area. The other thing that you're sort of driving at is there's a big transformation program going on as well within Openreach, which is trying to be more efficient and more effective at how one does one's work, right? And so, you know, there's 26 million lines to be maintained and managed. So Clive and his team are doing a fantastic job under that on multiple fronts. So you've got FTTP, you've got 26 million lines, and you've got transformation as well. So balancing our own people versus outside help is really, really important, because don't forget we're now building at 500,000 in a quarter FTTP. We're trying to get that up to that's a 2 million rate a year. We're trying to get to 3 million as quickly as possible. So Clive needs to work out how he does that in the most economically sensible fashion, so we don't commit to costs that we don't need in the longer term. So Clive, do you want to say a couple of things?
Yeah. Hello, Carl, and thank you for the question. Most definitely, we're going to use a mixed model. So we are going to use our employee base both to build fibre and to provision services over the new fibre platform, and we're going to use contractors in those two same areas as well. The sort of simple way to think about it is that we are going to bias towards contractors for the easier footprint build, and we're going to use our own people to do the harder, trickier stuff. And broadly speaking, it is easier to build in urban and suburban areas. It is much more challenging to do so in rural and super rural areas. And the same rule applies to provisioning. So where the provisioning activity is straightforward and simple, we'll use more contractor labour. Where it is more complex and challenging, we're going to use more of our employees. I do think, Carl, our employees are a fantastic differentiator. It gives us competitive advantage. We can do the tough stuff that others can't do, because they are very heavily dependent on contract labour alone. Thank you.
Carl, can I just add one thing, Carl? Thanks, Clive. Again, it's on the headcount, and I think, as Simon said, you know, we've got 3,600 less people now than we ended the year in. And the reason that's important, obviously, the cost savings, yes, but it's actually a demonstration of the company being more efficient. Because remember, what we're describing for you is a lot more activity. So again, Clive has described what he's doing, but across the business, we are seeing, you know, a lot of activity, and we're managing to deliver great service, and our net promoter score continues, and our customer service continues to go forward, and our churn is coming down. So that's a little formula that we're developing very nicely, and obviously we've got to do more of it over the coming years, but it's an encouraging start on that sort of formula, if you like.
And as you're seeing the actual kind of take-up accelerating, do you have any update on the kind of provisioning costs per home?
Yeah, I mean, the provisioning costs are still higher than we'd like. But, I mean, Clive's got a whole team, you know, working on how to reduce that provisioning cost and scale it up. And I think, you know, obviously, by definition, we've got much more expensive building than we have connecting. But I've got every confidence Clive's going to get that number down to the right sort of level.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we now have Nick Delphus from Redburn. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much indeed. Just a quick question on the comment on page 9 of the release about the potential for the pension fund to have a prior claim over certain BT assets. Could you talk a little bit more about any issues with self-investment rules or indeed whether those assets would need to be transferred into a separate entity? Thanks very much.
Sorry, Nick, I'm really sorry, it's distorted again. Can you repeat that question? Did you get it?
I think I got it.
Okay, sorry.
I think you were asking about, you know, the potential, a range of potential options for funding the deficit, and in particular, potential sort of asset back contributions. Was that your question, Nick?
Yes, and whether that would create any issues with the self-investment rules.
I mean, I think it's too early to say. We're looking at a wide range of options as we do routinely as part of the valuation process. I'm not at this stage, I hope you'll understand, Nick, going to comment on the specifics that we are looking at.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. So this is now John Carradice from Numis Securities. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Good morning. I just need to ask a question, please, around fibre investment enablers. Should we give up, for example, on seeing Openreach signed long-term contracts committing retailers to supply absolute number of lines over time? Secondly, should we really expect the government to give you a pass on cumulative rates given the costs of COVID? And then thirdly, given that Ofcom can't really say anything for the second five-year period, what sort of clarity should we expect Ofcom to be able to give by April next year? Thank you.
Sure. Okay, I'll give that a go. Look, we're still hopeful that we can sign the appropriate contracts with our CPs. I mean, the great news is we're up and running with all the major CPs now on FTTP. So, and the demand, as I said before, is very, very encouraging in the early days. So the challenge is actually, from a competition law point of view, signing up long-term commitments on volume. So what I can tell you is I'm very confident we will deliver brilliant contractual obligations between Openreach and our customers, which are the same for everybody, right? So that's what we've got to do. So far, I think we've got something in place which makes sense. Hopefully, we'll sign some bigger contracts, but we won't be able to tie up volume for very, very long periods of time because that's going to be deemed as anti-competitive. In terms of the cumulo rates, now I am very hopeful that the government, given the desire for the government to deliver gigabit capable networks by 2025, one of the things they could do is to reduce that cumulo tax effectively for the whole of the industry. So I'm hopeful that they will look at that, given the sheer productivity gains you can get from fiber. So I think that there's a big number to be gone for the country at large. So I'm hopeful they'll do that. And again, on the enablers, I think you can see where we are today. I think there's lots of encouraging rhetoric and commentary around the enablers, and not least the indexation, but also switch over 75% that you know so well. I think around the fair bet, I think there is, again, more encouraging signs from Ofcom that understanding the nature of our investment, which really is, it's a very long-term project. We're talking about 20 years here. So I think I would expect and hope that over the coming months, as we finalise the detail of it and it's published and from Ofcom in sort of early next year, I'm hopeful that we're going to get more signs that there's recognition this is a very, very long-term payback on our shareholders by putting £12 billion into building that full fibre network deserve a decent return over that long period of time. Simon,
thank
anything
you.
Else? Did I miss anything? No. John, is that okay?
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Thank you. So now Nick Lyle from Societe Generale. Thank you, Nick.
Morning, everybody. There's a quick one on enterprise, please, Philip. Could you give us some details, please, on any non-payers or whatever? Because your subs numbers look pretty steady in enterprise so far. So what's your policy been so far if an SME comes to you and talks about not being able to pay its bill? And could you also give us an update on or a reminder of how you set the bad debt policy, please? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I'll ask Jerry to give you some details. Now, as an overall point, I mean, I think in general, BT's worked really, really hard with all kinds of customer segments who have been under pressure for lots of different reasons. And of course, that's in lots of different areas, from the NHS specifically to NHS workers through to SMEs and lots of other segments. So elderly people, the vulnerable. So we've really stepped in there. With the specifics of SME, we have this sort of specific program SMEs to support them, and I'll let Jerry just give you a few details of how we've done that and also provide the view on bad debt. Is that all right?
Yeah, it's been an interesting period because all the way through the last 6 months, we've seen different dynamics through every month, really. But let me just try and give you a picture of where debt is and what we're doing about how we deal with customers, how we try and support them. So all the way through the initial phase of lockdown, we took a very customer-friendly policy. So what we had is a number of, you know, very obvious insolvencies and downsizing straight away, but actually not necessarily, customers just telling us they were doing that. We saw direct debits being cancelled. We also saw fairly quickly an increase in actually non-payment. If you look over the period, what we saw was about a 25% increase in debt. And the reason we saw that was partly because, in a large part, because what we did was actually we were taking very customer-friendly policies. We didn't cut anyone off. So if you took a like-for-like policy of where we had been before, where we would take them through the dunning process and after the, you know, after 60 days, we'd have started to see services, the like-for-like is an increase in debt of about 8%. You'll know that we actually at the end of last year, we took a £50 million provision for debt, and we're pretty comfortable that's covering, you know, our outlook for what's happened and what our outlook is. So in terms of debt, we saw definitely, you know, a quite significant increase. We allowed that to get higher because we wanted to make sure we didn't cut people off early. As I think I said at the last results, from July we started to take a slightly more, you know, not quite as friendly policy. We just wanted to make sure that people were contacting us because we saw a lot of the debt when we're chasing couldn't contact the customer. So the next phase was to make sure the customers contacted us, we'd give them terms to be able to pay it off over time, give them some free periods of non-payment, then they'd pay later on, extension the contract. So there was a number of policies we put in place to try and extend that. So that initial phase actually stopped pretty quickly. We didn't see an increase in debt, you know, post-lockdown easing. So week 7 of the year, we started to see that ease pretty quickly. We didn't see the debt increase very much through the period of week 7 to, you know, last few weeks. We have seen in the last few weeks, however, that the debt began to increase slightly. So, you know, very low single digits on debt increasing. And we will just keep the policies we have today going forward. So they're still not quite the same policy we had pre-COVID, and we'll make sure that we just review that and, you know, carrying on. Another way to look at it is we've got what we call the cure rate. How much does of our bills that go out, how much is paid, you know, in the period? And previously that would be running about 98%. It's currently running about 96%. So there's a couple of percentage points that we're seeing that it's just getting slightly worse over the last few weeks. So we're keeping an eye on that. The policies will remain customer-friendly, and you've seen whether it's the small business support scheme, and we've got 10 items there that we're trying to make sure they're just for those customers who are, you know, just trying to help them do business, whether that's about giving them cash flow benefits, just giving them tools to actually run their business. And we'll continue to look at that about how we support them. But it's definitely, as we sit today, we can see there's another phase evolving, and we're just reviewing our policies going forward about how to deal with SMEs over the next few months.
Nick, thanks, Jerry. Nick, happy with that?
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So now Sam McHugh from Exane. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, morning. Thanks, guys. I just wanted to ask a lot more about FY23, if I can. I think most of us know EBITDA is probably not the most useful metric, and especially with changes in capitalization policies, lease costs below the line, the sale and lease back of head office, et cetera, and maybe even a change in UK corporation tax. So I understand you want to give investors reassurance on the balance sheet and dividend, but I wonder if you could give a bit more color around cash conversion and cash flow growth over the next 2 years, kind of ideally on a post-restructuring basis. You know, should we expect this EBITDA growth to translate into decent cash flow growth? Thanks very much.
Sure. I mean, Sam, do you want to give it a second?
Thanks for the question. It's an important one. So, EBITDA is an important measure. It's a very important measure. It's the great measure for the success we have as a business in driving cash generation from our trading operations and the management of our cost base. So it's a important measure. I want all my colleagues in the room to understand how important the measure is. But in terms of cash, we have I think being pretty clear, Sam, that as we ramp up FTTP, that will see a growth in our CapEx. And if we get to the sorts of rates that Philip and Clive discussed earlier, we've talked in the past about getting to sort of peak CapEx with FTTP rollout in the 4.5 to 4.6 billion range relative to the sort of 4 to 4.3 that we're looking at today. In addition, if you look at the lease interest and tax, I'd expect lease payments to be relatively stable at their current level. Clearly, we've got cash tax and interest. If you add that with lease payments, it's probably running in the 2 to 2.2 billion range. As we move forward, we're going to potentially get a little bit of pressure on cash tax rate, but interest, cost of debt remains low for the group. So we've seen, in working capital, interest, tax, leases in the 2.1 to 2.2 range. We talked about specifics charges, and if you take sort of a rolling trend basis, it's probably running at $200 to $300 million a year. So if you take those three elements of CapEx, peak CapEx, working capital, lease interest and tax, and then the specific charges, do the arithmetic, you'll find at 7.9, the reinstatement of the dividend is fully covered. And obviously, as we move forward from there, we'd look to try and drive growth. Thanks, Sam.
Sam, I just add that I hope you do feel EBITDA is a good measure, because without that, we can't generate the cash in the way that Sam has talked about. And I just want to reiterate what we're saying today. We feel strongly that we'll be able to pay the dividend and invest in the numbers that Simon talked about, and peak CapEx somewhere between £4.5, £4.6 billion. That should augur well for the long-term future of the company, investing heavily, paying a dividend, and growing that dividend over time. So that's why the EBITDA of £7.9 billion in 2023 we think is quite important.
Right, thanks, okay. Thank you much.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you. So now Michael Bishop from Goldman Sachs. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. My question's on towers. It looks like Hutchison is talking about spinning out its European tower portfolio, including the UK towers, of which I guess a lot sit within MBNL. So I was just wondering if you could remind us of the MBNL structure and the ownership model, and ultimately whether you could do something with the towers within MBNL. And more broadly to that point, just what's your latest thinking on towers more broadly? Thanks.
Well, I'll get Simon to give you the short answer is not really. I mean, a lot of the sale and lease activity was done a little while ago. There are opportunities around the edges, I think, in our infrastructure, but there's nothing very significant. So there's important things we can probably look at, but it's complicated, and most of that, the big stuff's already been done. And we don't really want to look at any other sale and lease backs, which are just sort of mere financing type of activities. But, I mean, Simon, do you want to add anything on the structure of MBNL and how difficult it is to do that anyway?
No, a couple of key drivers from potential monetization of these sorts of assets. The first is, raising debt. We typically find there are better sources of debt. So you've really got to focus on what's the real value, intrinsic value that's created through these structures. And there may be opportunity for additional revenues to be generated if there is spare capacity on the asset, potentially some operational synergies through sharing as well, so OPEX. So where we have assets where there is a revenue or an OPEX opportunity that creates genuine value, then we will consider the next question: do we own and have rights to monetize that space? And if we did so, would it compromise the strategic flexibility and the competitive advantage in our network? And when we examine those questions, there are important but selected opportunities, and you'll remember a year or so ago, we did indeed monetize a portion of our towers estate. Specifically within MBNL, that is a venture which really does allow us to fully share our assets with a partner. In doing so, we feel we're driving the values off those shared assets. So not a major opportunity for BT, but there are important ones that we will go after where they hit the two criteria I mentioned.
Yeah, I hope that makes sense. Like, so, of course, we're looking at it, but nothing significant and major that we could go in that category, I'm afraid.
No, thanks. That's clear.
Any more questions?
Hello, thank you. Sorry, this is Paul Sidney from Credit Suisse. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I had a question on FTTP. Your fibre connections have now ramped up quite nicely to 13,000 per week. I'm assuming the majority are BT consumer customers. My question is, are there any other indications on what the average uplift in a customer's monthly bill is as they move to FTTP from copper-based products? Just really kind of get an idea of what customers' appetite is to pay more for the premium service. Thank you.
I'll get Mark to give you his perspective on that. I mean, yeah, you're right. Look, the build of FTTP is really exciting. I mean, it's four premises per minute. And you're right, we are selling 13,000 a week from Openreach. And again, you are right, the majority is in BT Consumer. But all CPs are now consuming and getting going on it. And I think BT Consumer has 600,000 customers on FTTP already. So it's beginning to be, you know, meaningful numbers here, so it's really encouraging. The other thing is it is premium price. I'll let Mark give you the sense of how the customers are responding to it and what they're doing on speeds and the pricing. Is that all right?
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. Yeah, we are, as Philip says, seeing really encouraging demand for FTTP, and this is reflected in the huge demand that we've seen in recent weeks, sort of post the lockdown, for better connectivity from all sorts of customers, particularly in the home, but also out the home with 5G as well. So we're pricing FTTP at a premium to copper and FTTC, and we're not seeing that impact demand. It's a premium that customers are paying in and around sort of £5 a month versus an FTTC equivalent. And we're seeing good demand, as we've said, close to 600,000 customers, and that demand is continuing. And off the back of that, we're also driving convergence as well. So I think encouraging signs that the UK consumer is prepared to pay a little bit more for a faster and more reliable service, and we think that's really encouraging.
Thank you.
Okay, lovely. This is Charlotte Perfect from RFA Research. Thank you, Charlotte.
Hi, good morning. My question is around long-term CapEx in Openreach. With the switchover moving forward, and with fiber maintenance CapEx being less than copper, I was just wondering if you could give us some guidance around what long-term maintenance CapEx might be in an all-fiber world. Could we even see this getting down to sort of 13% or below that sort of level? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Simon can give you his perspective. Just to say on the transition, I mean, clearly, you know, the faster we go in lots of ways is really helpful. So I think the vision for a, you know, 10-year, 2030, where copper is over in the vast, vast majority of cases, we're on a full fiber network, and we are an all-IP network shutting down some of our estate and all the exchanges that we know we won't need in the future. I mean, that's a really happy path for us to go down, and it has significant benefits across the board, and not least environmental, for example, needs less energy. But by definition, you're right, of course, to maintain that network will be less capital intensive by definition, but there are some big steps to that, because until you turn it all off, you've still got to maintain it. But nevertheless, you're right. I'll let Simon give you his perspective on the CapEx implications of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very focused on rolling out FTTP to the entirety of the country over time, and you know that is a very significant undertaking and is going to place you know significant upward pressure on the Openreach CapEx associated with FTTP, and we talked about ramping up to sort of peak build rate you know in the 23, 24, 25 timeframe. There will be some mitigation of that in the short to midterm as Openreach is able to dial back on the FTTC CapEx. There will be some mitigation. But we can see CapEx in Openreach staying in the similar sorts of levels as we roll out FTTP. When we get to the end of that rollout program, then, of course, CapEx will drop really very sharply because we'll have completed the program. And the cost of provisioning FTTP is considerably lower in the long term once we've got the lines installed. And, of course, the maintenance cost, ongoing CapEx, will be lower. So as Philip said, you know, when we get to the end of that rollout, this is going to be a business that's consuming much less capital, but we're some years from that.
And Charlotte, that was my point earlier on to another question about you know, the long-term nature of the investment and the need to get the neighbours from Ofcom in the right place, because clearly there is a great case here, but we're going to have to run two networks for, you know, at least a decade, if not a bit more, and that's costly as well as building a new one. So, but there's no question, if the fair bet is in the right place over the long term, and I'm talking, you know, 10 to 20 years, it's going to be a good outcome, and we're going to be left with a great national institution having a brilliant network for everyone to consume that is delivering fantastic speeds with great service and a low fault rate.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Thank you. So now we have Robert Grindle from Deutsche Bank. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, hi, thank you. It's also related to CapEx, bringing it back to the more short term. However, you chose not to narrow the CapEx range. Just to clarify, that's not to do with Huawei spares, which Simon flagged. Is it because you are expecting Openreach to accelerate again in the second half? And some of that cost is provisioning. Do you think you'll be able to pass on that provisioning cost to the CPs as you push for the volumes you hope to do, so when you strike a deal with them on the wholesale side? Thanks.
Let me talk about the dynamics on this year's CapEx. I'll ask Clive if he'd like to talk about how Openreach think about commercial arrangements around provisioning with CPs. On the CapEx trends for this year, firstly, there is a range, and we've maintained that range because we are seeing a reasonable element of our CapEx, which is driven by customer volumes. That's particularly in Openreach with pace of provisioning, but it also impacts the consumer business, where you'll know under our accounting we will capitalize some of the consumer premise equipment. Clearly, you know, more volume in those two areas during the course of this year will press us into the upper end of our CapEx range. Clearly, though, drives additional revenue in next year and beyond. So that's one uncertainty for us. The second is, in fact, that the Huawei and indeed Brexit stock, some of that will indeed be capitalized. And so that is also a feature that's driving the CapEx range. And then finally, you know, we have a very significant modernization program underway in BT. We are driving IT investment into maintaining customer service in our existing product set, but we are also developing the new product set. And there was also the range caters for, you know, differential pace in delivery during the remainder of this year. So those are the drivers, and that's why the range remains 4 to 4.3. Clyde, did you want to touch on sort of how you thought about provisioning costs with CPs?
Thank you for the question, Robert. The provisioning cost is not all passed on to the CP at the point of purchase. You can see the offer pricing that we put in the market to date, which is driving very high levels of take-up. Broadly speaking, it's £50 for a connection for a CP to attach one of their end customers to our FTTP network. It costs more than that right now for Openreach to do the connection work. What I am confident of, though, is that we will reduce the cost of that connection over time. We will do that by reducing the amount of labour time spent on the connection, and we will do so through reducing the component costs that we consume during connection. We are commanding at the wholesale level a decent price premium over VDSL once the customer is connected, and that will cover the connection cost over time. So I'm happy with the direction of travel on reducing the cost of connection. We do not recover all of it at the point of connection.
Thank you both.
Excellent, thank you. So now Polo Tang from UBS. Thank you, Polo.
Hi. Just a quick question in terms of consumer. Can you maybe just talk through what you're seeing in terms of the competitive environment and dynamics for both broadband and mobile? Thanks.
I think, Mark, you're probably best just to give you a perspective on that. That's okay.
Yeah. Hi, Paolo. Thanks for the question. Still remains a very competitive market for us, of course, but we've seen really encouraging demand over the last few weeks. So if I look at all of our channels, whether it's retail, digital, contact center, we've seen levels of sales and demand actually exceeding the levels that we saw pre-lockdown. So whilst it's a competitive market, the demand's good. And for the premium products that we're selling, FTTP, I spoke about that being it's a faster, more reliable, better network. And for that, we feel confident we can charge a premium. The UK consumers have taken that up in really good numbers. We've seen the 5G iPhone, the latest iPhone, or two of the four that are on sale right now, off to an encouraging start as well. And of course, these are products not cheaply priced. These are premium, fantastic products. And we're seeing good demand for that as well. We're seeing encouraging uptake in convergence as our Halo base grows, best of both off to a good start. So whilst the market remains competitive and very crowded, I feel like over the last few months our trading performance has been encouraging.
And can I just check, in terms of the 5G iPhone, could that result in more promotional activity in terms of the mobile market as we approach Christmas and Black Friday?
Well, it's a bit early to say, Polo, because I think we're, you know, it's only recently gone on sale. We've only got two of the four items of the product launch on sale. And the promotional period of Black Friday, Christmas, I think it's going to be very different this year for a number of reasons. Some retailers are choosing not to participate. Some of the promotional activity, I think, has been brought forward. So we'll have to see. It's a bit early to say. I expect, as always, it's going to be a very competitive market. There's lots of choice for the UK consumer out there and you know, lots of brands in a very crowded space all vying for attention. But we're performing well and trading well despite that level of competitive intensity.
Thanks.
Thank you. So now David Wright from Bank of America. Thank you, David.
Hi guys, thanks for the opportunity. Just a quick question. We obviously had the Virgin Media O2 presentation submitted with a series of pledges. One, of course, included the ambition pledge, however we want to describe it, to build a further 7 million houses with a gigabit capability, which I think we imply is broadly FTTP. I just wondered how you guys thought about that, whether you'd seen any obvious kind of acceleration in competitive build in your experience, but also when you look at your longer-term return on capital, return on invested capital assumptions for the Openreach fiber build, to what extent you have competitive infrastructure build of that scale in your modeling. So just any thoughts around that would be really appreciated. That would be good. Thank you.
Yeah, look, I'm very happy to give you my thoughts, and maybe Simon might want to chip in as well. Again, you know, looking at the overall build program, you know, again, we obviously have got a plan to build, you know, 20 million premises by the mid to late 2020s. And when we built the business case, we made a number of assumptions around that. And clearly, there are other builders planning to do a similar sort of activity, not to the same sort of scale. I guess the important point for us is really a couple of things. One, the speed at which we can build. The scale of the program, the cost, which is incredibly competitive compared to anywhere around the world. So I think we've got a real competitive advantage there, and also the quality of the product. And you heard Mark talk about how his customers are responding to that, and we can see other CPs, the likes of Sky and Vodafone and TalkTalk, all seeing the full fiber proposition as being very, very strong. So that technology is definitely the winning technology in our perspective. So we just got to build as fast as we possibly can and deliver that, and I think there's the demand is out there. Of course, there'll be competition by definition, but we're very, very confident that where we take our fiber proposition, the demand will come and we'll do well on it. So, do you have anything else on other people's build?
No, I mean I think we clearly do see as you do, lots of communication of ambition over time. Often quite hard to sort of understand exactly what timetable is associated with that and the extent to which it's ambition already stated that's been changed in some way. So we try to follow that. But in terms of our assessment of the build and the returns, absolutely we take into account a wide range of scenarios, and that's built into the 10 to 12 range of returns that we have talked about. What I would say, of course, is that we're really focused on getting on with the build. We're building at an incredible pace can cover the sort of target that you described in 2 to 3 years. That's the sort of pace we're building.
David, maybe just to give you some sort of tidbit of encouragement, if you look at our opportunity in the big cities, I think, with fibre, I think that is something that you'll see BT make good inroads in over the coming years. I think there's a decent-sized opportunity for us to go after there when the full fibre product comes on stream. I think we're very excited about that.
Okay, very good. A little faster building, sorry, would be appreciated, but that's just my very personal view. Thank you.
Thank you. This is now C.E. Hay from Citi. Thank you, C.E.
Hello. Thank you for taking my questions. I just have a quick follow-up to the previous question. I think Virgin Media and O2 also talk about the potential open up the network for wholesale. I was just wondering whether that could impact the way that you structure your wholesale agreement with CPs so that you can increase the take-up before any potential rollouts going to take place. Thank you.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a good question. As Mark said, in general, in his area, it's really competitive, but also in Clive's area, it's really competitive, as we just described. So there's a lot of people out there seeing the opportunity of great digital infrastructure, specifically, fiber and fixed line connectivity. So a lot of people out there building, no question. And, how the wholesale market plays out in this new, very, very competitive dynamic, who knows? I go back to the point of saying BT will have the biggest and the best footprint for FTTP. And I believe that all the CPs will want to connect into that network because it's the best and the cheapest and delivers the best service for our customers. Does it mean that there aren't other options to people? Yes, there will be. Now, if some big CP decides to put all their volume not on the Openreach platform, of course that would affect us. Would that bring the returns down? Definitely it would. But I still tell you, even in those situations, the investment case makes sense. It will be lower than we would like, but it still makes sense, and we'll keep ploughing on delivering that massive build of 20 million homes by mid-2020s or late 2020s.
I'd add to that, Philip. I mean, it is a recognition that there are a wide range of scenarios for this build, which is why the fair bet is so crucially important. Our investors need to have confidence that they will be able to benefit from the upside scenarios because they're taking the risk on some of the downside scenarios as well. So that's a very important part of the FTMR process that's underway.
That's a crucial point. So, as Simon says, there is not insignificant risk in this by definition for the reasons you're saying. What we're saying, what we believe is BT has to build a significant footprint and will be successful. That I'm sure about. How successful, I don't know exactly, because the market, as we just described, is very competitive, it's very uncertain, and there are loads of moving parts, right? So there's build, there's take-up, there's other technologies, there's competition, there's a whole host of this pricing. So, that dynamic is what we're dealing with. And the great news for BT is, we've got a unique position. We are the market leader, and people really, really value the kind of propositions and products that we offer and that we're building right now. So I think in the long term, that will be a favorable thing for shareholders, as long as that we can get that sort of fair bet terminology right in the regulatory framework.
That's very clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So now James Ratzer from New Street Research. Thank you, James.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, and good morning. I had a question I'd like to dig in a bit more around the headcount reduction, please. Firstly, an encouraging start on the first half this year was the 3,600 reduction. Just want to check how much of that is then net of the disposals, because it seems like a lot of that did come in global services. And then secondly, would just love to get your thoughts on then how that run rate develops over the next 2 to 3 years within your program to grow EBITDA to FY23. How should we think about net headcount reduction from here over the next 2 to 3 years? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a sort of an overall answer, maybe Simon can talk about the net and disposal effect. Look, as I've said many times, you know, our sort of agenda here is very straightforward. It's, you know, to build a stronger BT, a better BT, and modernise the company to make it, you know, really competitive and dynamic for our customers in the future, and a great place to work for our colleagues. I said over the next 5 years, there's no question we're going to have less and less people. Okay, but therefore we plan to do that in a steady, professional, thoughtful way. And what's driving it is using technology to make it easier to connect into BT as a customer and for people who work here. So I expect that to see a steady continuation of that trend of less people being at BT. And my main aim is to use natural attrition, for example, which runs at about 10% as the major driver of that. And I think we've seen quite a lot of that in this number so far. And we'll continue to do that, right? So we've basically really tightened recruitment, and we've really been very, very careful about thinking about getting people into the business. And that's probably the single biggest driver of that, I suspect. So I put us down for continued gradual reductions in our workforce over the next few years as we grapple with new technology and put it in place. Simon, anything on the global headcount?
No, in this year, the 3,600 does include the benefit in the hundreds of some divestments. But, you know, bear in mind we've also made some quite significant investments in our workforce. We have insourced a number of operations which we believe we can do more efficiently internally. We have been bringing customer service activities back into the UK, which creates an increase in headcount for time. So the net number is after divestments, but after also investments in the business to drive better customer experience and sales. So the underlying efficiency-driven reduction is meaningful and will continue.
And the other thing, sorry, you know, it triggered in my mind, and Clive's obviously recruiting engineers to build the FTTV program as well, so it's another example. So that's net of all that activity, and so we'll continue to recruit more people to build the network to get up to the 3 million a year from where we are today, which is a run rate of about 2 million.
Thank you. So that would imply that then the kind of net run rate of around kind of 7,000 a year should be achievable for the next 2 to 3 years.
I wouldn't extrapolate it at that rate.
But then based off your earlier comments, sorry, why not, I suppose, if we're saying you did 3,500 in the first half and there's going to be continued efficiency and natural attrition?
Yeah, you've heard that concept of a low-hanging fruit, haven't you? Particularly when you're at the beginning of an exercise, you know, and what we're seeing is the sort of swim off of the first transformation program, which, you know, sort of came to a close at the end of this year. That carries on through. The real trick here, and the reason we're quite cautious, is we're not just asking people to leave or not getting people to do their work. We're changing the work. So the work's got to go. So unless the work goes, we're keeping the people, because we've got to deliver for our customers. So that's why it's not as simple as a straight line in the way you're describing it. So we're going to make sure we deliver for our customers, make it a great place to work, and we believe we will need, over the next 5 years, less people. And in the end, it will be significantly less people, but it will be steady as she goes. And the most important thing is to maintain the delivery of our service for our customers and do it in the most efficient way, which, as I say, will need less people. But I wouldn't extrapolate the run rate that you've got in the first half.
Can I also...
Got it. Thank you.
Philip, one other point. You know, we have got a significant modernization and cost transformation program underway. That is going to deliver £1 billion of gross cost savings in FY23 and a couple of billion in FY25. That will be delivered. That will drive the costs down. It will also deliver some net cost reduction, as we described in our guidance. In terms of the mix of our own people versus the third parties that we use, you heard indeed Clive talk about getting that balance right between internal and external. The same is true in some of our shared service activities. The same is true in some of our IT activity. The key is delivering gross and then net cost reduction after appropriate investment. The mix of that between our own organization, third parties, that's something we'll get right for every single decision as we move forward. And that's what will then drive the shape of our own direct workforce.
Yeah, and that, sorry, just final point again to say, and within that sort of £2 billion cost program, clearly less people is a big part of it, but also there's many other very important moves in procurement and other costs which are part of that program, which, again, we've made a lot of progress in the £352 million that we announced annualized in the first half. You know, it's many other things in there as well along the lines I've just suggested, which is, again, is very encouraging, but it's early days.
and there's a lot of hard work to be done over the next few years.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now Jerry Dellis from Jefferies. Thank you, Jerry.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. The question is really on enterprise. From the outside, you know, enterprise generally seems rather opaque, but obviously you've managed to put a range of outcomes on it in order to define your March 23 EBITDA guidance. So, I mean, as we look at it, there's a billion of fixed voice revenue declining double digit at high marginal margin. The mobile market looks pretty competitive, and we're looking forward to PSTN switch off in about 5 years' time. So perhaps could you clarify for us what enterprise looks like as we navigate past the COVID situation towards building towards your FY23 guidance, please?
Yeah, look, I'll make a couple of comments, and maybe Simon and Joe, if you want to chip in. I mean, look, you know, you're broadly right, okay? I think that there is this still, you know, a few years of sort of negative outflow of legacy voice, and that does need to flow through, of course, you're right. I think when you step back, there are, you know, once that's out the way and we've sort of focused on the newer type of activity, I do see opportunities in mobile, I do see opportunities in SME, and actually, as we mentioned in our results, you know, you can see that the corporate and public sector is holding up very nicely, and some of the pipeline wins that we've sort of mentioned and some of the numbers you see there are sort of quite encouraging, of course, early days. So I think that you're right, it is challenging, and some of the numbers are speak for themselves. But I think, you know, over the medium term, I can see that the tide changing slightly when those price downs and the regulatory downs sort of move away. Simon, anything to add, or then we'll ask Joe to make his...
Well, I think we should go Jerry.
Jerry, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think that covers the broad brush of it. But I mean, in terms of the opaque comment, I do understand the nature of enterprise is very diverse. So you get lots of different moving parts within the business. I think the key dynamic in terms of the legacy voice is very clear. Mobile is probably the most impacted by COVID. And if you look at the financials on mobile, actually the whole mobile base. The base is we're trading well. And what you see in terms of the downside year on year, there's about 30 million in there. Half of that is a move to SIM only. So what we've seen is like handset has certainly been, you know, sort of an area where people over the year, but actually especially through the last period, we've seen people not want to renew on the basis of a handset in the B2B market. And the other half is out of bundle, and almost all of the out of bundle impact on mobile is actually roaming. So we do see that actually with the trading and the move away from COVID, we'll start to see more out of bundle. Actually, the service revenue ARPU, just on service revenue, is pretty stable. We've got about a 5% increase in the base, and we're certainly through the last period, we've seen about a 5% dilution in terms of the service revenue. So I do think that will come back over the years. I think what we're seeing, you know, we're not having the Apple 5G, people having to renew their handset base. We see a big focus on that through mobile. So there's definitely an opportunity in mobile. I think what you see in the broadband base is the revenue per broadband connection at the moment is actually pretty stable year on year. We've certainly seen an impact on wholesale where there are price impacts. But again, I think the broad brush of our trading is strong. We've definitely got the impacts of COVID that is affecting the numbers. I think they will come back over time, whether it's going to be this year or next year. But I think over time we'll start to see those come back. So in terms of this networking, fixed, broadband, mobile, I'm pretty confident on that. I think where we definitely have the issue is the headwind of legacy voice. That's not going to change. And we've got the headwind of the MVNO loss. But I would say I think the underlying trading can be pretty strong going forward.
We've got our last question now, I think, from Adam. Is that right?
We do, yes, thank you. This is Adam Fox-Bromley from HSBC. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you very much for making time for my question. It's around Openreach's relationship with end customers. To me, there seems to have been a bit of a step up in rhetoric from a number of service provider customers in recent weeks, particularly around pricing. The tone of the prior 12 months appeared to basically be constructive across the board from all parties. So I wondered if this was a function of moving to the last stages of the regulatory consultations, or if there were any other concerns that are emerging. Thank you.
No, I mean, again, Clive, you should comment here. Again, what I would say is, you know, Clive and I spend quite a lot of time talking to our major customers, and I have to say, I think the relationships are really, really strong, and okay, you can see in some of the feedback Clive gets from the CPs on the performance that him and his team are putting in. So I think it's really positive. When you're looking at fiber, clearly, you know, that is the future. Everyone recognizes that, and I think, you know, we're galloping away and building so much pace in the program of build and also now sales. I think everyone's beginning to think, right, we need to get cracking here. And I think that's what you're seeing is people thinking through their business models now that fiber is here. It's here and it's here to stay, and it's going to start accelerating even more. So that's all you're hearing. We've got to find a way of delivering a program into the market, which at the end of the day, it's the same price, the same terms for everyone. That's the nature of the beast with Openreach. So people can talk about what they want. In the end, we're going to listen to all the CPs, get all the feedback, and find a compromise that works for everybody to deliver what the country needs, which is brilliant digital infrastructure on an FTTP platform that gets as many customers on it as quickly as possible enjoying the benefits of that service. Clive, do you want to add anything on the conversations?
Okay, thank you for the question. We are intensely speaking with all of the service providers around FTTP. The whole thing's become really real, I think, for the CPs. You know, sales volumes are increasing very rapidly, as Mark talked to you about earlier. CPs are getting their IT sorted, they're getting their processes sorted, they're experimenting in the marketplace, they're trying to understand what level of premium for what tier of speed will customers be happy with. So they're trying to work out their pricing. And, of course, they're in deep dialogue with us about the kind of pricing structures that they think they need to support their businesses. In the round, though, loads of engagement here, nearly all of it very, very constructive. And, you know, as an industry, we're going to go to this fiber platform together, and we will debate just how and at what pace and at what price point we do all of this. So you are going to hear lots in the press and in other fora, because this is now very real. Fibre's arriving. We've got a footprint already addresses 11% of the UK population, and we're building at a rate of 2 million homes a year and still accelerating. So it's because it's very real that you see the debate kind of leaking out of meeting rooms and into the press.
Great. Well, look, thank you, everyone, for all your questions. They were great questions. Really enjoyed engaging with you, and thanks very much, and see you next time.